to welcome you people, the other to introduce the personalities at the table. In terms of that first responsibility, let me extend to everyone a warm welcome at this second conference of the Central Illinois Council of World Affairs, the conference topic being the new politics, dissent and violence, international phenomena. As you might guess, a program of this nature takes a lot of planning, and a few of the people we will be introducing here tonight on the platform have been involved in this planning since last September. Several others who have been involved in the planning will be introduced tomorrow. But the point that I want to make is that this planning, this work, began last September. And since that time, there has been at least one meeting per month with respect to this conference. But at one of our very early meetings, of course, we were discussing the possibility of the topic, just what our topic would be this year. And we thought about many possibilities, American foreign policy, Latin America, the Middle East. And then we hit upon this particular topic as being very timely. And if the advance registrations for the two-day meetings are any indication, and I think they are, a very wise choice was made last September with respect to the topic this year, because there's a tremendous amount of advanced interest, and we're glad to see you all here. Those of you who have not yet planned perhaps on attending some of the sessions tomorrow, we would hope that you would reconsider and try to be with us for the panel in the morning, speaker at noon, and the panel in the afternoon as well. All right, I have a list of people here to introduce. I must confess that I do not really know all these people. I've just barely met them in some cases. I trust that I will not slip up on any pronunciations here of anyone's name. If I do, I apologize in advance for this. I would suggest, too, that we withhold our applause until everyone has been introduced, and then give everyone a round of applause. But I would like the individuals, as I refer to them, to stand up and be recognized by the group. I will begin down here at the far end of the table on my left. First of all, we have the Reverend A.J. Copeland, who led us in the invocation earlier in the evening. Coming this way, sitting next to Reverend Copeland, is Mr. J. Ivan Saunier, who is a graduate student at the University of Illinois. He will be one of our participants tomorrow in the afternoon panel, which is panel number two, the topic being the student revolution. Henceforth, when I introduce someone who is on panel two, I suppose I would just say panel two, but panel two is the student revolution. Mr. Saunier will be on that panel. Next to Mr. Saunier, we have Mr. Alan H. Andrews, Jr., the superintendent of police in Peoria, Illinois. He will be a participant in the morning session, the morning panel, the topic being student dissenters, minority groups, police, the escalation of violence. Mr. Andrews. Next to Mr. Andrews, we have the Dean of the Division of Extension at the University of Illinois, Dean Alan Andrews. Pardon me, my statement, Mr. Robinson, yes. next to Dean Robinson, a participant in the afternoon meetings, panel two, a senior in political science at the University of Illinois, Mr. Thomas Schwartzfeger. Resident of Springfield and a member of the University of Illinois Board of Trustees, Mr. Ralph Hahn. The next individual here has there's a comment after his name which is no lengthier than the comments after the names of the other individuals, but I would point out that he is a very distinguished professor of political science in this country. He has been associated with several outstanding universities. He is presently on the faculty of the Department of Political Science at the University of Illinois, Professor Norton Long. The next individual is one of the individuals who's been very much involved in the planning of this conference. He served as the co-chairman of what was really the steering committee for the conference. He represents actually one of the three institutions that is really sponsoring our conference. He represents Lincoln College. Professor Joseph DeLillo of Lincoln College. I trust they're all his students. moving to the far end of the table here on the right, another panelist who will be on hand tomorrow afternoon for the second panel. He's visiting professor currently at New York University on leave from his home institution, which is the Free University of Berlin. Professor Klaus Meschkat. The other individual who has served as co-chairman of the steering committee of the Central Illinois Committee on World Affairs, or Council on World Affairs, another resident of Springfield, an individual I trust many of you know much better than I, an attorney locally, Mr. Grumman.
I didn't bring my chair in a second.
Another individual who will be with us tomorrow afternoon on the panel on student revolution, student at the University of Illinois and active in the organization Students for a Democratic Society at the University of Illinois, Mr. Robert Dietz. Another student from the University of Illinois, an individual who may be better known than some of the other individuals on the platform, because I think you have seen him in the news or on the TV films recently, representing the Black Student Alliance, or the Black Student Association at the University of Illinois, Mr. Dave Addison. Now, the next individual is the one individual who has done, I think, more than anyone else in terms of making this program, this two-day program, a success. In a sense, I might say, why not? It's his job. He's getting paid for it. But I wish you could be one of these individuals who has been working with us for many months to appreciate the dedication and the enthusiasm that this individual has for his job. It's nothing short of remarkable. It's an amazing enthusiasm and dedication that he has in connection with his work with the University of Illinois Office on Extension and International Affairs. This is Mr. Terry Iverson, and he will introduce at this time our speaker of the evening.
Thank you very much, Professor Rickabaugh. Can everybody hear okay? Our keynote speaker this evening is no stranger to most of us. Born in Greenville, South Carolina, 27 years ago, he has undergone a wide range of social and educational experiences that have been equaled by few of us, regardless of age or background. After graduating from Sterling High School in his hometown of Greenville, he turned down a contract to play professional baseball with the Chicago White Sox and chose instead to go to college. The University of Illinois was his first choice. He spent 1 year at the U of I on a football scholarship, but left at the end of that year because of the lack of social mobility which he experienced. He continued his college education at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical College in Greensboro, from which he received his Bachelor of Science degree. After completing his undergraduate education, he was accepted at a number of theological seminaries to continue his education. He chose the Chicago Theological Seminary and was awarded a grant by the Rockefeller Fund for theological education. As a college student, our speaker assumed positions of leadership both on and off the campus. In 1963-64, he was a delegate to the United States Youth Council and to the World Assembly of Youth. During the same 2 years, he was the president of the A&T College Student Government. Moreover, he was elected president of the North Carolina Intercollegiate Council on Human Relations by representatives from all of the colleges and universities in the state of North Carolina. In this capacity, he was appointed liaison officer to the office of the governor of North Carolina, the then Terry Sanford. His involvement in the civil rights movement was exemplified early in his life when he became the leader of the movement in Greenville, South Carolina in 1960 and in Greensboro, North Carolina at A&T College in 1963. Throughout the decade of the 1960s, this young man has won the hearts and the admiration of blacks throughout the world. And now he is regarded as one of the most articulate leaders of the black community. Among the many honors which have been bestowed upon him include membership in Who's Who in American Colleges and Universities, the 1964 Greensboro Citizen of the Year Award, the Omega Man of the Year Award for epitomizing four cardinal principles, manhood, scholarship, perseverance, and uplift. And finally, the Chicago Club of Frontiers International Man of the Year Award, which he received in January of 1968. It is indeed my pleasure and my honor to introduce the Reverend Jesse L. Jackson, the Associate Minister of the Fellowship Baptist Church in Chicago and the National Director of Operation Breadbasket of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The subject of his remarks is the Black Revolution and New Politics. Reverend Jackson.
Thank you very much to the guests on the dais, to the many brothers and sisters that are gathered here tonight. During this crisis period in the history of our nation and in the history of our lives, I'm glad to have the chance to be a participant in this conference and to make some small contribution. I am overcome somewhat with a sense of nostalgia as I see some of my classmates that I attended the University of Illinois with. Jewel Butler's here someplace. We called him Sausage when I was in school. Where is Jewel? There he is. And I really have a kind of phobia about downstate Illinois. I decided after I left Champaign that I wasn't coming back this way anymore. My experiences there were so traumatic, and yet I am so grateful for them, because had I not experienced the dilemma at Champaign, Illinois, as a freshman at the university, no doubt some of my sensitivity and perspective that I now have, I would never have known. For some of my other frustration was the result of recognizing that I was victimized in South Carolina. But then to come to the land of Lincoln, furthermore, a Big Ten university, and experience the downright contempt for my person as well as my talent, threw me into a psychological bind that many never really overcome. I found myself as an athlete being used as a big trained animal, Saturday afternoon spectacle, but never really meant to be a participant in the governmental structure of the institution. On Friday nights, when the whites were relieving themselves from the week of academic tension, we found ourselves in a corner at Prince, drinking beer and playing cards. During the spring of the year when the whites were having the major balls and the intercollegiate fraternity balls at Huff's Gymnasium, we found ourselves out in Champaign, up over the VFW Club playing 45 RPM. We were integrated on television on Saturday afternoon trying to win the Big Ten championship, but not as quarterbacks. Johnny Easterbrook had to have a broken leg and a broken spirit to allow Amell Myers, a far superior quarterback, to even get a chance to play, and he played until Johnny was healed. My chances of being an athlete and a man were so diminished until I made the decision to leave. Except at that time, I could not articulate my anguish. As a young man of 17, I only knew that I was extremely hurt. And as I tried to challenge my fellow black brothers to recognize that we were in a dilemma, many of them had the hard, cold choice between going back south, playing before 8,000 people with no recognition, over and against taking the long shot chance of playing before 90,000 people at home and playing before a national television audience and having pictures in the Daily Illini. When they contrasted the two alternatives, most of them at that time in our history, at that time in our sensitivity, chose to subvert their manhood, waiting for a brighter day. Thanks be to God that a new fertility has risen in the soil of black America, that a new sense of manhood has now taken over us. To that extent, you find your Thomas Smiths and your Johnny Carlos are standing up in the winner's circle as men, telling the truth of their talent by their superior speed, but also telling the truth of their circumstance by their superior commitment to a moral truth in spite of the material price that ultimately the both will have to pay. And in the great tradition of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who would not bow to Nebuchadnezzar in spite of the price that they had to pay, we find these two young men symbolically expressing the same desire to hold their heads up and not bow to a star-spangled banner that does not, in fact, represent them. And so I'm kind of glad to be back home, to be in an area where hypocrisy has had a chance to live for a long time, where injustice has been on Main Street, where injustice has been in the Capitol building, where injustice has been in the state houses, and where racism has infused itself throughout the institution with no academic, emotional, personal, nor political antidote coming forth as a solution to relieve the pain. As I looked over the schedule and looked at the topics, new politics, dissent, and violence, I was hit with a bit of fear as I tried to wrestle with discussing new politics. And I finally concluded that my frustration was that as I searched, I could find no signs of new politics. I found some old phenomena with new names. I found some new phrases. I found another generation taking up where their dad has left off. But I haven't found any new politics that would deal at cutting the prerogative of exploitation fostered by the old politics. Politics from the perspective of the black community, ecstatic. My grandmother was 68 years old on last Saturday. And she cannot read, nor can she write. Nobody's political program has reached her. New Deal didn't reach her. Great Society didn't reach her. Black capitalism won't reach her. None of the catchy names given to the old stagnant political alliances are designed to reach my grandmother. We find the blacks living in what the sociologists call ghettos. But really we know that they are not ghettos wherein an ethnic group chooses to live in a certain community based upon its arrival from the old country, welcomed by the Statue of Liberty. We know that it's not a certain area in Central City America where people of a certain ethnic group control the institutions, and where that ghetto, as a result of its powers, can choose to interrelate with other ghettos and form what is called an interrelationship or an interchange or integration. The fact is, we didn't set up the area in which we live, and we don't control the area in which we live. As a matter of fact, if one will observe the records and the minutes of the International Geographical Congress at Leopold in 1875, where the great white European nations were discussing colonizing Africa. And there was some discussion about America joining in the colonization, the Belgian Congo, the French Algiers, where Cecil Rhodes set up the Rhodesia. America was invited in, but given the populist movement, and given the strain of the Civil War, America was in no position to participate effectively. But at a minor level, she at least sent an ambassador to represent her in Belgium. And incidentally, that is how we were involved in the Belgian Congo crisis. But at that time, protected by the Atlantic and the Pacific, someone raised the ingenious question, we've given them a check for 40 acres on a mule, which would be substance to freedom, which would be the gold reserve to back up the check of the Declaration of Independence. Someone says, who can stop us from withholding the gold reserve? Someone said, no one. Then the Democrats and the Republicans came out with an agreement, the end result of which we were freed into capitalism without capital, leaving only the ism, or the bark off the tree, or the symbol of freedom, likened unto releasing a fish into a bowl without water, which forces that fish to live in contradiction to his nature, forces that fish to live without fish integrity. In a social kind of way, we call it an Uncle Tom. But really, he is not a black man who lies in the bed early every morning figuring out a way to hurt other black people. But really, he is a black victim and a white creation. A man forced to serve two masters, to live as a white shadow rather than a black image, with an enlightened mind and a spiraling, weakened backbone, not really being able to stand up straight enough to be a father image to his children, a husband to his wife. At that time, they said, reject the 40 acres and the mule and set up colonies, not ghettos. Ghettos suggest a certain social relationship. Colonies suggest a certain economic relationship. Then one asks, what is the purpose for the colony? Where is the colony? It is the area that you call the ghetto, where the black people reside. Who are the colonized? The people that live there. Who are the colonizers? The people who live on the outside but own it. What is its purpose? To be a margin of profit for businesses? To be an area where a cheap labor base is developed? To be an area where soldiers come from during a period of war? Then why haven't white America killed the colonized? Because the slave is more use if he is alive and working. The slave has more value to the economy, more value to the military, if he is alive. If he, however, rebels too hard and he becomes an economic liability, then discussions of genocide begin to come to the forefront of discussion. When we, in the colony, ask to be integrated, ask to be a part of the mainstream, we're met with bricks, sticks, and stone, and without the protection of the military. When we reside in the colony and say we want to control it, we are accused of being separatists. So if we integrate, we are attacked. If we separate, we are attacked. Which means America is not satisfied with us being stable at either place. Seems that she wants us in a state of limbo, a state of frustration, not standing still long enough to build a base. It is tragic and bad that living in the colony, you're separate. But the white community, apart from the colony, is also separate. But the qualitative difference being that the white community is separate and independent. And the colony is separate and dependent. What do I mean by dependent? We do not control the executive jobs in the colony. We do not do the construction, the building of sidewalks, the building of streets, the building of roads, the building of buildings in the colony. We do not make decisions about urban renewal in the colony. We do not even determine definitions of ourselves and our own concepts of beauty in the colony. We do not control the economy of the colony. We do not control the financial institutions of the colony. We don't even control our own appetite in the colony. But even worse is that a University of Illinois or a Bradley University, with the resources to analyze the problem just as I have analyzed it, are not even training the blacks to liberate the colony. 4 years of exciting white people on Saturday afternoon. Hope you get a pro contract, but if not, a degree in push-ups. Major disrespect. Encouraged to get in physical education. Grips, yes, but to study the colony. Not to develop remedies, my brother, to study the colony. It is bad that materially we suffer. But even worse, over a period of time, not being able to be a man among men, spiritually you suffer and begin to drift into a state of despair and a state of hopelessness, where you begin to lose confidence in yourself, where you begin to look in dishwater, begin to look at water in a gutter and say to yourself, I'm ugly. Not realizing that you're not really ugly, the water is dirty. You're really beautiful. You begin to develop mind problems. You become insensitive to your own need to be. Therefore, we'll walk by every day with a PhD worth of information in our heads, making $11,000 a year, walk right by a white man without a high school diploma as a plumber, making more money, as a truck driver, starting out at $12,000 a year with an e-license, making more money. And it doesn't even bother you over a period of time. Look out and see your enemy, who was a Ku Klux Klansman in his own neighborhood, now in yours with a blue uniform on. Change the order of a rose, but the essence remains the same, which means that the black community is under constant military occupation. Don't have to have on green uniforms just to represent the military. You moreover find that those uniforms are not there to look for overpriced food. They are not there to look for slum landlords. They're not there to look for schools that take up 12 years of your time for 6 years worth of education. They're there to keep the colonized quiet. They don't want order. They want quietness. Why not order? Because order presupposes the proper arrangement of things. And the proper arrangement implies a certain need for justice and balance. But quietness means to have a toothache, to have a cavity, stick it full of Novocaine, and close your mouth, but not deal with the aching tooth. Ezekiel said it, speaking in biblical terms. When you walk into the black community and see the hopelessness, see the signs of futility, begin to feel the anguish and look at the expressions of nihilism, it becomes likened unto a valley of dry bones. Dead, despaired, desperate. We don't control communications in that colony. 1969, we cannot build a 10-story building from the ground up in any city in this nation. We don't control the Board of Education for our black community in any city in the nation. It makes those of us that analyze acutely, it makes it difficult for us to stand erect to songs talking about land of the brave and home of the free. Because it's truly the land of the brave and the land of the burden. But it's not the home of the free. And when one recognizes that, you can go to Vietnam and fight for the freedom of America's foreign puppets. When you can fight against America's so-called enemies, those enemies can come to this nation and have more social mobility than a race of people that represent 30% of the casualties. It makes you reassess your relationship to the nation. Some argue, but you Americans, in spite of the price, all of us have had hardships. I ask, what makes me an American? Is it the respect I get? Is it the freedom I have? Is it my job chances? Is it my life chances? What is it that makes me an American? Some say, well, Reverend, you were born here. You know, I'm from South Carolina. Had a cat named Puff. Puff got pregnant. Got up in an old range stove we had in the backyard. Gestation period over. Puff had some kittens in the oven. But just because they were born in the oven didn't make them biscuits. And just because we've been trapped here in the oven, it really don't make us American biscuits. The American biscuits are treated a certain way. They are respected a certain way. They have a certain social mobility. They get a certain price back for their investment. American biscuits. And we don't get it. And we've never gotten it. In one sense, the blacks are bound in the colony. But in another overriding sense, the whole of America, while so many have spent their times holding us down, has spent an awful lot of time having to be present to hold us down. And thus everybody is dealing with each other horizontally rather than moving on out vertically. That's why America is overproducing the world's richest nation and under-consuming, with 40 million people hungry tonight in this nation. Because even though we overproduce, our under-consumption is a reflection of corruption at the level of distribution. Let us analyze all of America, why there's a bottleneck at the level of distribution. One, Jesus took a forthright position on ye shall know the truth. And he said you would get a bonus if you ever really knew it. You would get free. Now, we have a habit of telling lies to ourselves and hiding reality behind words and facades. You know, we're excellent at majoring in manners. We're excellent at using long words to say short things. And we have the union card to use those meaningless words because we so often have a meaningless diploma. But we got to show it off because we spent 4 years and $4,000 earning it. But just as all motion is not progress, just because you're talking does not mean that you're necessarily saying anything either. A poor man on the brink of starvation takes some apples. We say he is stealing. And he is a thief, and we are struck with horror. But a rich man doesn't have to steal apples, he steals $1 million. But since he has social sanction and has made such major contributions to our churches and our universities, we call it embezzlement.
Yeah.
Steal means stealing, you know. You go on a step higher, and when the real thugs of the nation, the pathologically sick men who make decisions to kill off a generation of people for wars they are too cruel to define, because they have the label of senator or the label of president, we don't call them thugs, we call them earnest, hard-working men who are subject to mistake in search of truth, using the procedure of trial and error. Finance Committee, the Appropriations Committee, is controlled by Russell of Louisiana. How did he get his seniority? Blacks couldn't vote. Whites were locked out using the method of poll tax. A new politic can't just argue with Russell as a rotten fruit. It must deal with the rotten root that produced a Russell.
Right.
The Ways and Means Committee, Meals of Arkansas. New politics must deal with the root that gave him his seniority. The Judiciary Committee, the Justice Committee. Chairman Eastland of Mississippi. New politics had to deal with the root that gave the rotten fruit its power. The Armed Forces Committee that commits us to war, a drunkard. Mendel Rivers from South Carolina. Education and Welfare, Yarborough of Texas. All white men above 65 with no stake in life itself. And black people are hemmed in somewhat by such a pathological bottleneck of thugs up top. But all of us are victimized by men running our government with not even the intelligence to make sound, decent, and moral decisions. All of us. Being a country preacher, I don't want to get caught using words that did not have at least some common understanding and meaning. The word dissent was on the brochure. And I understand the word dissent broken down. Dis means a part. Sent, a centile, means to feel. Put it together, it means feeling apart. And there are a lot of people in this nation who are feeling apart. They're feeling separated. They're feeling alienated. They are indecision. And fortunately, some have been pushed apart. But others who are now waking up talking about saving the whole world from annihilation a wanting to be apart from a certain old politic that has produced such sickness and such frustration. We can't speak of new politics unless we analyze old politics. Constitution said that blacks were three-fifths human. Three-fifths human. Well, that means three-fifths the chance to live. Three-fifths more likelihood that you will die before some white person will die. Three-fifths the chance to eat. And thus, three-fifths the chances that you will more likely steal rather than starve. Three-fifths the chance to be educated. Three-fifths the chance to be respected. Three-fifths the chance to be protected. That was when the Constitution was put together. But the gap is even greater in 1969. Our chance of getting a house close to where we work is a greater percentage than 60%. Chance to be educated. Chance to get a comparable salary with a white man with the same training, the percentage difference is greater. Oh, I remember too well. Even trying to learn how to articulate my anguish in 59. Walking one day to football practice by Huff's Gymnasium. And I saw Ray Nitschke. One who attended, not one who graduated, one who attended University of Illinois. And J.C. Caroline, one who did not graduate, but who attended. But the greatest All-American in the history of the school, compared only with Red Grange, riding on the back of a dump truck, picking up paper off the ground with a stick and a nail in the end of it. Over near the stadium, putting up a picket fence for the freshman football team to practice in, J.C. Caroline, the greatest All-American in the history of the school, and Ray Nitschke walking in Huff's Gymnasium, shedding tie as an assistant coach in the offseason, traveling across the nation for the school, encouraging young boys to come to the University of Illinois, talking about, hey, J.C., talking about my man. J.C. came from South Carolina in the early 50s. Jesse came from South Carolina in the early 60s. This is a change that took place, y'all. And the most standing up on the back of trucks and picking up newspapers and nails in the end of sticks. That's kind of out. That's old politics. Old politics of racism. We say, well, Kerner kind of overstated the case. He wanted to be a judge. Just a few poor people down south who don't know any better are guilty of racism. I first had to define racism. It is a belief. It is a form of worship. It is an idolatry of one group. It is a belief that the other group is congenitally inferior. That the other group ultimately should be committed to genocide because it does not have the right to exist. If it does not have the ultimate right to exist, it does not have the penultimate right for respect. That's what racism really says. How did that creep into America? The Economist said that we need slaves. We need them in the worst way. We got an economic system called mercantile capitalism. We need slaves to get our profit. The politicians and the lawmakers justify whatever is necessary to run the economy. Men cannot do wrong long without looking for a moral rationale. So they organize some ecclesiastical pimps called theologians. They come in with a moral rationale justifying slavery, quoting out of context, talking about slaves be good to your masters, talking about you are from the children of Ham, cursed by Noah. Luther and Calvin debating whether or not black men had a soul. While the American church lost its sense of moral tension with the economic order, slaves had to sit up in the balcony of churches while preachers on the first floor spoke of a universal Jesus Christ. But the fact is, the Christian cross, with its universal quest for justice, had been put beneath the American flag in its quest for national domination. But it went a step further. It went a step further. The social science of Bishop William Stokes from Oxford came up with a thing called the Teutonic theory of racial origins, which argued that in substance that the great minds, those that had formed the institutions of the world, the stable institutions, came from Europe, from Germany, discounting the civilizations of Egypt, Mesopotamia, discounting the civilizations of Ghana and Songhe and Malai, the great cities like Timbuktu, discounting who discovered hieroglyphics, who started the writing process. He didn't let that theory stay in England. He brought it to Harvard. He brought it Columbia University. He brought it to the University of Wisconsin. And the great intellects, the great liberal teachers sat back just outside of Cambridge and debated while the professors at the universities justified racism with the Teutonic theory of racial origin. University of Mississippi had not even been organized. I mentioned Harvard. I mentioned Columbia. I mentioned the University of Wisconsin. I mentioned Oxford. Then the natural sciences, supposedly devoted to detached objectivity, again to talk about the cephalic index, black people's brains being too small to harbor great thoughts. So the economists, the politicians, the theologians, the social and natural scientists, in concert, put out a certain medicine that was shot into the veins of all of white America. And that congenital sickness exists this night. If for no other reason than no concrete institutional antidote has been shot into the bloodstream to offset the sickness, if for no other reason. Old politics. Oil depletion. More than five farmers in America receive $1 million a year not to farm. 15 were paid between $500,000 and $1 million a year not to farm. 388 between $100,000 and $500,000 a year not to farm. All in all, 6,579 farmers receiving more than $25,000 a year not to farm. In South Carolina, Congressman McMillan on the Agricultural Committee gives 1% of his population $5 million a year not to farm, while 53% receive less than $1 million a year to survive. In Texas, 1,900 farmers received $413 million a year not to farm. Some people did have a great society. in the ghetto. Beyond a match, what did we have to do violence with? Federal budget last year, $157 billion. $85 billion to an undeclared war in Vietnam. $13 billion to the national debt, 80% war created, and the remainder to veterans of past wars. $108 billion of $157 billion. Only $19 billion to health, education, and welfare collectively, which meant that our leadership, the fellows of the old political order, who received their power upon the prerogatives of slavery, 70% inclined toward killing, 12.2% inclined toward healing. What goes on in the ghetto as a reflection? What happens on Capitol Hill is of no comparison. It is inconsequential. If I told you I believed in liberation by any means, some of you who would want me to be a great white hope would say, "Oh, Reverend, how can you say that? Liberation by any means." But it doesn't disturb you when President Johnson or Nixon says liberation by any means. When they say preserve peace in Asia by any means and at any price. Living in a sick nation. Six to eight percent of the nation making all the major decisions for the rest of us, black and white. Extreme concentration of wealth, old politics. Extreme poverty, 40 million people in the nation making less than $3,000 a year. New Americans are more white than black. Percentage-wise, more black than white, old politics. Kill blacks if we are violent at home. Kill us if we're not violent abroad, old politics. A draft system that says in substance, the poor and the black die to death and be the vanguard of warfare. How does it say it? Everybody admits that white schools are superior because of appropriations and facilities. Certainly not for any innate reason. Black schools are inferior because of lack of facilities and appropriations. The black boy and the white boy take the draft test downtown. The white boy makes the highest score and goes to college. The black boy makes the lower score and goes to Vietnam. Old politics. There's not a slum in America tonight that is illegal. Police are in Harlem right now, Southside Chicago right now, East St. Louis right now, Champaign over by the VFW Club right now. Police are there, and they're not looking for a slum landlord. They're not looking for a store with double standards in its pricing. They're not looking for a store manager selling rotten meat. They're not looking for a school system that takes 12 years to give a child 6 years worth of education. That's the breakdown in law and order. That's old politics. Violence as a force in politics didn't start with the Watts Rebellion in 63. They tell me it started with the killing of the Indians. They tell me it started with the enslaving of the blacks. They tell me it started by keeping the poor whites and the poor blacks ignorant. They tell me it was continued by having the poor whites and the poor blacks argue about skin color. In a horizontal confrontation where men were fighting over jobs that did not exist. never allowed them to fight the vertical fight between the haves and the have-nots. Chairman, that's old politics. I'm looking for a new politic. I hope that this conference will discuss the seriousness and the depth of racism. I would hope that each white person would ask himself, where am I gripped? Where am I deformed by racism? Not just can I react to a black man running a football or shooting a basketball, but where do I stand existentially at the question of race? Can I participate in the ocean of humanity? Or must I reserve a place for the preservation of white skin and worship it? New politics, a job, or an income for everybody. Not just a black capitalism that speaks of an economic ceiling for a few people, but to talk about an abundant economy that can provide an economic base for all people. Not just a ceiling for a few people, but a base for all people. Basic reason tonight why America is the world's police rather than the world's savior is that about 20 to 30% of our energy is spent arguing about food and about clothing and about housing, rather than spending that same energy on developing doctors and lawyers and scientists, majoring in a minor, I say, and fucking in that. It's getting a little late for racism. It's getting a little late in the evening for us not to admit the truth of America's dilemma. Why did not come as a man hating white people? Not because history would not tell me that I ought to, but because I know that hate is too great a burden for me to bear. I will not give you the privilege to get inside of me and control my temperament. I am a well man. The doctor has a responsibility to walk down the corridors of the hospital, giving injections of truth to any sick man that he sees, no matter what color he is. The doctor cannot make excuses for the patient's sickness for his wild actions. He must keep on pumping truth. New politics should produce some well men, should produce some doctors. But I want to say, as we hold on so tenaciously to our chairs and speak of ways to sacrifice our children, while we hold on and fill up our pantries and our deep freezes while men starve, that it's not going to be easy to bring about a new world. I know that the price of freedom is going up, that the road ahead is dangerous, that it's long. I know that it is uncertain, that it is perilous. I know it's full of ambushes and jails and assassins. But as I read the signs of the times, there's a certain group of people in this nation, hurting black people and enlightened white people, who have an irresistible desire to live in a free world. Tyranny has lost its power. There's a certain song that we hear on the right-hand side of the dial, stations beamed at the black community, called "I Feel an Urge Coming On." And it's coming on stronger. Not necessarily a program, not necessarily a plan, but an urge. an indication that somebody is awake. Little children in Mississippi sang, "We've starved too long." They feel that urge. Mothers standing up on welfare with dignity, with all the profundity of the mother from Hickory Hollow Swamp, saying, "My child will not will make me stand up." She feels an urge. Black men saying, "No more yes, sir, boss." Black students says, "Yes, you can have our minds. You've got to put information in them." They feel that urge. Jamaicans telling Alcoa Aluminum the bauxite is ours, Jamaica for Jamaica. They feel that urge. Biafra saying to America and to Britain with our odd interest in the east region of Biafra, "We might have to die, but the Lord put this oil here for the Biafrans to bargain over." Saying in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Before I'll be a slave, I'll die and be buried in my grave." They feel that urge coming on. Ezekiel captured it by saying that in spite of being a Jew, enslaved in a valley of dry bones in Babylon, along with his moving, he saw wheels moving in the middle of wheels. That was the urge in Babylon of the Jews trying to get free, just as there's the urge of Black Americans trying to get free. But also, just as our ghetto, our colony, is one wheel, America has another wheel. But even if America's wheel does not move toward justice, there are people in the third world, people in Asia, people in Africa feeling that urge. The universe itself, with the harmony depicted by the sun, the moon, and the stars, bending toward justice. One writer said the arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. The universe feels that urge. Black people, enlightened white people, in your new politic, urge to be just, urge to be decent, urge to tell men to stop their war games, beat their swords in the plowshares, beat their spears in the pruning hooks, stand up and tell men, stand at war no more. I know that 10% of our nation is living off a military budget, but it doesn't matter. I know it's dangerous, but somebody in this world got to have some guts, and a few men in this world got to have some sense. Thank you.
At this time, as soon as we give Reverend Jackson a chance to get a drink of water, I would like to entertain questions from the floor. However, before I begin, I would like to please, for each of you who has a question to ask, to make it very brief and very concise, because Reverend Jackson has a plane to catch in just a few minutes, and we would like to get in as many questions as we can. Okay, I'll entertain the first question.
Question.
Yes, sir.
How does Mayor Daley figure in the new politics?
The question is, how does Mayor Daley figure in the new politics?
Not even with a computer. You know, I have a rather pessimistic view that grows out of some experiences. But part of the problem in Chicago, apart from Mayor Daley's commitment to a certain traditional style of politics, is that there's not a two-party system there. And to the extent that you have a Republican Party in Chicago, it's just like one snake with two heads, where the chief Republicans in the city have great jobs under Mayor Daley. and they do not even have the urge to set up a two-party system themselves. And because of that, the alternatives under which he makes decisions are of such until there is not the pressure for him to have to even make a politically just decision. That is the only reason why I endorse the two-party system. It really hasn't worked because it's been so bound up with racism in this country. But in one sense, that is the genius of the American political system. And though I have given up on the Democratic Party, I haven't given up on democracy. And so Daley will almost be in proportion to the pressures of a new political alternative as well as new political challenges. I'm not so hung up on Daley personally because I understand structurally where he really stands and why he does not have to move. I didn't hear you. His question is, what are the black colleges and universities doing about educating the blacks to go back into the ghetto to help their own? Good question. They haven't been doing very much until the students decided that's what they were demanding. But they also, the black students who understand the nature of the public economy recognize that though we're not at the majority at the University of Illinois or at the majority at Bradley, that and though we call them white schools, that they are our schools too. And that the students are not going to run from there back down south. They are going to make those universities be consistent with their pluralistic justification for being. The fact is the University of Illinois is as much as ours as Morehouse is. The question is, what is the University of Illinois or the other great made Northwestern and other universities around the state doing to academically react to this situation rather than emotionally? That's why I was so upset at the University of Wisconsin when I went up there some time back, that everybody was reacting emotionally to what was essentially an academic proposition. And that is, in a pluralistic society, how does one give the blacks the sense of ethnic identity, the sense of history, the sense of well-being, the sense of preparation to live where they will have to live within the context of our ethnic breakdown? And these are questions that seemingly any sociologist who would analyze the situation properly should have been able to advise. The demands offered by the black students in most universities should be demanded by the white faculty. In Chicago, where we had the shop in?
Right.
Ward's grocery store.
Right.
There's a grocery store in Chicago, a black-owned store that was having problems developing business, and we dismissed our Saturday morning meeting early and urged people to shop in there. And they did, and it has helped. But what is important to recognize about how the racism has affected us is that whites will not shop in his store because they disrespect black people. But blacks will not shop in the store because they are so committed to following the patterns of white people until they disrespect themselves and project that disrespect onto their black businessman. That is how we are psychologically bound by following the patterns of the larger society. To that extent, an orientation on the part of black people to have enough help to respect each other is one part of the problem. But on the other hand, to have whites who stay within two blocks of his store go eight blocks to another store because of his black, because he is black, is also a part of the educational process.
Yes, and I could ask you, and follow along just exactly what you've just been saying, that in your speech, that you rather emphasize this following the white pattern of being a doctor or a lawyer in Indian State. Could you give me some idea of how you feel about why so many of the black people have spent so little time in their, all their energies that are now being expended so much about
done to make this country a great country. For example, in the field of cooking, I am positive in my personal experiences, and I'm sure in many others, that if you go to a Negro home and sample the food, whether you go down to Mississippi or Louisiana, or whether you go to the south side of Chicago, or whether you go to a rich black person or a poor black person, there aren't finer people in the way of cooking food or preparing drinks that a person loves to have than the black people. They are certainly superior in that area. Why play it down? And why follow the patterns of saying that being a doctor or a lawyer is more important than being a cook or a bartender or one of these other occupations, which certainly should have equal dignity?
No, don't laugh him down. You see, a long time ago, when I was a little younger, my ego would have found it necessary to chop into him and make y'all laugh. But I've gone a little past that now, not trying to embarrass anybody. He's right, we do need to take those talents we have developed and control them and charge our price for them. But that is not exclusive from also having our position in the professional classes. And you see, the whole Du Bois Book of Washington breakdown was along the same thing. Booker Washington said, drop your buckets where you are. Said, we're good cooks, and we've learned to be cooks by necessity. Say, control that. We didn't take it serious, and that's why we're not the major chefs in the nation. He said, drop your buckets where you are and learn to build bridges and sidewalks. We didn't take it seriously, and that's why we can't build them. He said, if you're going to build, if you're going to use your muscles, build railroads. But then Booker Washington was joined by Du Bois, but they were split by the Atlanta Constitution. But Du Bois said, what does it matter if you can cook if you don't have the technical intelligence to organize your cooking into a cafeteria? So what does it matter if you can put down railway ties if you don't have enough political power to get railway rights to run your tracks? You follow what I'm saying? So they're not mutually exclusive. There is a certain drive on the part of blacks to do this now, but when I start talking about the colonial powers from the outside controlling the black community, the latest trend, for example, in janitorials is not to have the sleep-in janitor that does the mopping and the sweeping, and at the end of the day he does it and leaves, but the latest trend is to get a group of janitors and contract your janitorial service out to a company. The whites with the technical education come in and get a group of unemployed black janitors and hire them and pay them a salary and put them to work in their own community rather than blacks controlling the janitorial aspects of the black community. The extermination, we do not control the killing of rats and roaches in the black community in this nation. Mr. Arkin comes into the black community, gets black men who need relatively little skill, teaches them how to skeet some juice out of that little thing. He organized it. You follow what I'm saying? So our cooks are organized, but by the colonizer. Our janitors are organized. Our exterminators are organized, but by the colonizer. Somebody said, well, don't black people have enough sense to organize themselves? Well, if blacks went to borrow the money to start the janitorial company, the white bank wouldn't loan them the money. That's why you must develop the black bank. And if he borrowed money from the bank and his own son, whom he could trust, were not the lawyer, then the contract probably would not be sufficient to cover his area. Therefore, you must be able to deal with the whole gamut. And I might say this, that black power and the control of the black community is probably the most American thing ever happened to the movement. All ethnic groups have done it historically in this country. And it is from the organized talent of the nation's ethnic colonies that come the government workers and leaders downtown. I was with two fellows today from the governor's office. They were in college. They participated in the student government, learning how to run that. Mind you, the University of Illinois, I was cut out of that. But they were learning how to run the student government budget, head of the finance committee and stuff in college. Then they got in the what they call it, U.S. Student Association? USA? No, no, not the Black Student Association. The other one, the big student association, the NSA. Got in the NSA. They learned how to do it there. Then they would get involved in city campaigns politically. Black people couldn't get involved. They were learning it there. Then state campaigns. And then when their candidate wins, the same guys with just average Joes become all of a sudden the head of the Department of Finance of the state or the chief cabinet member in Washington. And blacks are locked out of that process from the student government all the way to the federal government. Black Easter. Insight on Black Easter. Last question. I got to go. I don't want to miss my plane. I promised the Lord I wasn't going to stay close to Champagne no more if I can. Black Easter is an attempt by black people to capture the rhythm of a traditional holiday and turn the symbols into substance. Talking about an anti-white Easter, given our urge to participate in the affairs of the nation, probably will not work. But to talk about a black Easter, number one is to deal with the phenomena of resurrection. We historically have thought that resurrection was an event just related to Jesus. But resurrection is a phenomena. There are some characters in the life of this world whose lives are so full until when their hearts stop beating, they don't really stop living. And six feet graves can't hold them. They just keep on living. They are resurrectable. And people who are around them usually capture their spirit and keep them alive through all forms. Therefore, in addition to resurrecting Jesus for those committed to the Christian faith, for those that are just committed to the resurrection of our race, we'll go back and get a Daniel Hale Williams in medicine, or Charles Drew, or Alexander Dumas in literature who wrote The Three Musketeers, or George Washington Carver who found 300 odd products in the peanut, or Malcolm, or Medgar, or Dr. King, and resurrect these heroes, and rather than Easter being a period of new clothes, it becomes a period of renewed peoplehood. That's the first point. Second thing is that Jesus was not only in conflict with the Roman government politically, he was in conflict with Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle philosophically, because they believed that justice begins at the level of actuality. That's why they perpetuated the pyramid of the class theory. Jesus believed that justice begins at the level of potentiality. That the man ought to be respected not because of what he has, but because of his isness, because he is. That's why he could identify freely with the pimp, with the prostitute, with the woman at the well, with the sick people, because I'll take a tax collector like Matthew and make him one of his running partners. I'll take an old thug like Peter and make him one of his boys. Jesus ain't nothing but 11 high school dropouts and a doctor for his cabinet. You know? You know, so this thing of getting people, the haves, to relate in a creative way to the have-nots becomes a part of a real Easter. Also, the word Easter itself means spring. Just that simple. New period of the year, coming out of dull, cold winter. Something new. Well, if we must buy new clothes, buy them from the black dealers who are being crucified so as to help resurrect them. Psychologically, rather than use the white rabbit as the symbol, we're going to use black sheep. I mean, you know, Easter has to be meaningful for our lifestyle. The black sheep, one, he comes from the East. Black people come from the East. He's one of the oldest animals known to man. We're one of the oldest races known to man. The black sheep has value. He gives wool for clothing and meat for food. Black people have value. The ratio of white to black sheep is about one black sheep to every 100 white sheep. But the black sheep tends to be a leader sheep. That's one of his qualities. Well, who was the leader for justice in Mississippi? Was it the governor or was it Medgar Evers? Who was the leader for justice in Harlem? Was it the governor or was it Malcolm X? Who was the leader for peace in the nation? Was it the President Johnson or the Prophet Martin King? The leadership. In other words, the season becomes something meaningful and real. It becomes a reliving period. And I would hope that that we wouldn't just go through these ecclesiastical gymnastics in church on Easter Day dealing with some Jesus image that does not have any substance, but where we look at the period itself to allow. You know, Jesus wasn't running when he got caught. He allowed himself to be captured because of his commitment to justice, believing that if he would renew himself through death if necessary, that a resurrection was inevitable. And if you can make that same kind of commitment to life during this season, then you can rise on Easter Sunday morning. Not just Jesus, you can rise. If you come to grips with the effect that your using a black insurance company and developing it would have, your banking with a black bank, or your help putting the proper content in schools so as to alleviate the pain off of black students, you're figuring out a way to prod your politician so as to get him to take a position to help the poor. If you begin to see some of that happening, you will find yourself rising. Therefore, Easter really, though it is symbolically captured in this period, the Easter holiday, rather than being a Sunday in April, becomes an event in life available to anybody willing to go through a crucifixion in order to get a resurrection. Thank you very much.